The Flying Walendas, the famous Family High Wire Act, descend from a family circus troupe that toured European villages as far back as 1790. Carl Walenda was born in Germany in 1905 and began performing with his family when he was six. He came to America when John Ringling saw the four-person human pyramid Carl had created on the high wire, and he contracted with them to appear in Madison Square Garden in 1928, where they debuted without a safety net because it had been misplaced in shipping. Their courage and crowning achievement on the high wire galvanized the crowd. Over the next two decades, they continued without a safety net. Their human pyramid evolved to include seven persons, as Carl was here building a circus of his own. Then one evening in 1962, the front man on the wire faltered and the pyramid collapsed. Three men fell to the ground. Two died that night, and the third, Carl's son, was paralyzed for life. Carl and his brother fell to the wire from the second level, and the young woman on top fell on Carl, who held her until a safety net could be brought underneath. The next evening, the uninjured Walendas were back on the high wire. How? Why? How could they carry on like that? As Carl would later express it, this simply: being on the wire is life. Everything else is just waiting. Being on the wire is life. Everything else is waiting. Is that true in some way for all of us? I want you to turn to the back of your order of service. Our seven principles are listed there. And I'd like to read them with you, taking turns on the principles. I'll begin with just the opening to it and invite you to sing, to read. You could sing if you know how. I don't. The first principle, I'll do the second, and we'll alternate through till you end up with a seventh. As Unitarian Universalist congregations, we covenant to affirm and promote justice, equity, and compassion in human relations.
Acceptance of one another and encouragement
of spiritual growth in our congregation. A free and responsible search for truth and meaning.
The right
The goal of world community with peace, liberty, and justice for all. These are our principles, forged three decades ago over 3 years of surveys and drafts and responses and discussion continent-wide among our congregations. When consensus was achieved in a landmark vote on the floor of the 1984 UUA General Assembly, cheers resounded around the hall. A confirming assembly vote was required the following year, but the work was done. We, Unitarian Universalists, had freshly re-envisioned ourselves as a movement of faithful people, of open hearts and minds, a principled people. Fresh insights, emerging issues, and evolution in the use and meaning of language will foreseeably lead us into re-envisioning in years to come, because we are one with life itself in refusing to stand still. The process by which the Christian creeds emerged many centuries ago was similar. the wrestling with words, wrangling with meanings, sweating away hours and angst. But there were fateful differences. In those ancient church councils, only the bishops voted. And once issues were decided by majority vote, they were carved in stone. They defined the true faith. To differ from then on was heresy. Nonetheless, differences arose and led to splintering and schism. The division of the church into Eastern Greek Orthodox and Roman branches, and then the Protestant Reformation, and many more splits and schisms. It was not so much specific differences, but the very issue of difference itself that led to churches with no creeds at all, like ours. As Francis David, one of the earliest Unitarians, proclaimed in Transylvania 4 centuries ago, there is no greater piece of folly than to try to exercise power over conscience and soul. You need not think alike to love alike. Others have echoed this since, not all of them you. Krishnamurti emphasized that truth is life, and life has to be discovered from moment to moment, from day to day. It has to be discovered. It cannot be taken for granted. Life doesn't stand still. It moves. And if I stand still, it goes on without me. To venture life in this view, in our way of faith, is to leave the security of solid ground, of a creed, of any truth presumed absolute, including one's own of the moment. Acrophobia, the fear of heights, is more accurately described for many acrophobes as fear of falling. This is true for me. I'm not fearful in airplanes. I'm afraid at the edges of cliffs. I thrill watching rock climbers from the safety of a theater seat at IMAX, but my wide-awake nightmare is echoed in the news story years ago of a man who stepped out of his car to take a photo of the Grand Canyon without setting the emergency brake. He watched in helpless horror as the car rolled forward, plunging his wife and family over the edge of the gorge. There were freight train tracks that bisected the route between the house in which I grew up in Chicago and my high school, creating a serendipitous shortcut for walking there. Heading home leisurely in the afternoon, my best friend and I liked to walk on the rails, balancing ourselves with our books and our bags. It's a curious thing, perhaps true for more of us here than not. If you were to set a 4x4 wooden beam on the floor from here to the doors, I could probably walk across on its top side and cross the room with fair confidence. But stretch it that far at waist height, and I'd probably fall. Stretch it across the same distance, 20 stories high, I would be paralyzed with fear, fatally so. My fear of falling would be my doom. When life itself looms that fearsome, that perilous, when the future is a chasm of uncertainty, folks grasp tenaciously to anything safe, secure, and solid, like salvation. People build theologies on it. Hell-bent theologian Jonathan Edwards held New England audiences in the 1740s spellbound for 1 hour, 2 hours at a time. with his graphic descriptions of sinners in the hands of an angry God, dangling over the flaming inferno of hell and eternal damnation. The pit is prepared, the fire is made ready, the furnace is now hot, the devils stand ready like greedy, hungry lions waiting for their prey. It is only the power and mere pleasure of God that holds you above it by a thread. And it would be a wonder if some that are now present should not be in hell before this year is out. And it would be no wonder if some persons that now sit here in some seats in this meeting house in health and quiet and secure should not be there before tomorrow morning. They didn't laugh. They broke down in fear and tears, fainting fits and convulsions, and they converted en masse. The roiling emotions unleashed by the Great Awakening fed the revolutionary fever that was soon to ignite the colonies. The rebound effect of such hellfire fervor was also powerful, but more subtle. Distaste for such fanatic zeal led men like Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Jefferson and John Adams to establish freedom of faith in this new nation. And profound dismay at such abominable theology ushered them each into Unitarian and Universalist views. Unitarian in envisioning a cosmos of high integrity, intentionally knit together, and rationally comprehensible. Universalist in uplifting a creation wholly worthy of trust and devotion. Slip back in imagination into the pew of a country church decades later, and hear a Universalist preacher depict God as a loving parent, like the Father in Jesus' famous parable of the prodigal son, a nurturing God who leaves the latch key out until the last child is home. Hear echoes of a planet, of a cosmos that continually evolves, creates, and recreates, and that will not, cannot ever throw you away. Release from fear is true salvation, freeing us to live even in the face of very real danger and always uncertainty. The carnage in Tucson, the devastation in Japan remind us our world is awash in danger and uncertainty. Yet to be on the wire is life. Did you know there's a word in the vast lexicon of English for tightrope walking? It's funambulism, from Latin roots for rope and walking, funambulism. Funambulism? Apparently for tightrope walkers, they master it by positioning their center of mass where their weight is concentrated. This is scary. Directly over their base of support, their legs, unless they're handstands, never mind that. Directly over their base of support while moving. And you know that sounds like a guideline for life? Positioning one's center of mass directly over one's base of support while moving. It helps, helps tightrope walkers to use a balancing pole, a long, flexible pole weighted at each end. This enhances their ability to counterbalance the subtle shifts in their center of gravity as they walk the wire. Life has its high wires, too. And we have something, something akin to a balancing pole here in our way of faith. It's our set of seven principles. It's easy to scan those principles and dismiss them as self-evident, like motherhood and apple pie, or cake, a piece of cake, but only if you scan them lightly. Seen truly, they're a full course dinner, sustenance for the journey of a lifetime. There's a profound dynamic at play within these seven, a striking symmetry and interactive resonance that was not recognized when they were composed. A handful of colleagues, notably Reverend Lex Crane and Francis Manley, began dialoguing about this via email a dozen or so years ago, wrapping in Reverend Walter Royal Jones, who had chaired the commission that gave birth to the principles. Roy confirmed that the dialectic we were exploring had not been consciously designed. I recall magical moments from an upper-level undergraduate course in college studying classical English poetry. I loved that class for the hidden beauty we learned to see and hear in subtleties of image, rhythm, and sound. The poet did not consciously, intellectually design all that. It was essentially intuitive. Great poets are. Artists in ancient times believed they were partnered by the Muses, daughters of Zeus, sources of such inspiration and evocative grace. It was religious educator Francis Manley who discovered what she has called the principle behind the principles, the essential tension between these compelling yet competing ethics. Take a look. Number one, we begin with the worth of the individual, separate, unique, alone, and conclude, paradoxically, affirming that each is an inseparable part of the whole, the web. Francis perceived all seven principles as points along a continuum, each of them growing directly out of the relationship between individuality and the interdependent web and mediating the tension between them. Each value, a response to the tension in various facets of our lives, in personal relations and in world community, 2 and 6, in congregations and in society as a whole, 3 and 5, and in the middle, we find the free and responsible search for truth and meaning. To Francis, this suggests that the meaning we are searching for is to be found precisely in the tension between our existence as separate individuals of worth and dignity, and at the same time as interdependent parts of an indivisible whole. It was my contribution to this dialogue to notice competing values built into each of those middle principles themselves. So let's take a further look. The second principle uplifts the ethics of justice, equity, and compassion. Ethical dilemmas are dilemmas precisely because they encompass conflicting values, and compassion very often struggles with justice. Equity would strike a balance, both tempering law and upholding it, yet never does the balance hold still, because life doesn't. Our third principle contains another paradox, accepting each other as we are, yet urging that we grow larger than these selves we have accepted. It says, hey, don't go to sleep. There's more to discover. We're not done yet. The fourth boldly links freedom and responsibility, the first principle with the last. Freedom is knit into existence, as quantum physics has observed, and it's essential to life and hope and possibility. Yet to be responsible is never to be truly, totally free. We are inextricably linked with each other, and what each of us does affects the future of us all. In our fifth principle, conscience and democracy collide. Need I tell this to citizens of a state capital? Causes we support passionately lose at the ballot box. Will we then take our cherished convictions off to a prison cell? Or a desert island, or stay in community and carry on with shreds of hope for another day. The world community of number six carries these prior principles to their logical culmination. Its peace is not the enforced peace on a battleground after a victory, not the peace of surrender. Enduring peace requires justice to sustain and liberty to safeguard and defend. Thus, peace is not always peaceful, not placid. Notice how these dynamic seven expand in their numerical order from personal to communal to global to cosmic. From one to all. That all we variously sense to be sacred, our unique selves, each part of a holiness that encompasses all of existence. Our principles urge us into the mix of it, to wrestle with each paradox and grow with the whole of life. Rationalists, which we also are, yearn to capture and secure truth and pin it to the ground as passionately as any fundamentalist. But truth cannot fly that way. The noted biologist George Wald reflected upon this once upon a time. All great ideas come in pairs that negate each other, and both contain elements of truth. Each generation has the satisfaction of overthrowing the idea in one of its forms, each succeeding generation the triumph of rediscovering it. This is the very mechanism of progress. Like a screw or a spiral, it advances as it rotates. Science turns the idea around and about, now accepting it, now rejecting it, giving it always fuller, more detailed meaning. The great idea emerges originally as a vague intuition expressed in myth and poetry. In this form, science finds it, clothes it with fact, analyzes its content, develops its detail, rejects it, and finds it ever again, he writes, while the myths still sing to us and poets spin the vision. We do not ever wholly lose the intuitive. You can't stand still on a high wire, not for long, I think. I'm not going to try it. I would freeze, go rigid, trying not to move a muscle, even to breathe. It's not the height that would do me in, it's my fear. The hardest part is that I would have to look down to stay keenly aware of my feet and where they are going, when fear would draw my attention to how far I would soon fall. Keen awareness is vital to full and faithful, faithful living. I dare say most of us are afraid in life of far more than we need to be, and probably often afraid of the wrong things, things that would not kill us, but would make us strong. We are built to move, every muscle and tendon and bone and joint of us, built to move, not to stand still. To be well grounded is also good and feels good, but rigidity is deadly on the wire or on the ground, and whether it be rigidity of body or mind. As career diplomat and sixth U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, Charles Yost once said, "Show me a man with both feet firmly on the ground, and I'll show you a man who can't get his pants on." We cannot pin truth to the ground either. Niels Bohr, the great 20th century physicist, observed that the opposite of a small truth is a small error, but the opposite of a great truth is another great truth. The opposite of a great truth is another great truth. Our principles play this out for us like music. What unites us here is not a creed, a set of shared beliefs, but rather dancing values. Inwoven through them is a profound understanding of the rhythmic nature of life, of truth, of creation. Our principles are ethical music. We can dance our lives to them. Let it be a dance we do.